Earth, sky.
This is a fascinating substance that, for some reason, nature chose not to give us. And that should inspire people's curiosity and get them to look harder, ask questions about why this is and why is the universe the way it is. That's the kind of thing that inspires us to go looking.
You are listening to physicist Jeffrey Hengst of the University of Aarhus in Denmark, and this is Earth Sky's Clear Voices for Science. Professor Hengst is one of the world's leading researchers in particles of antimatter, which he described as a mirror image of particles of the regular matter that makes up the universe as we know it. Professor Hengst said his lab has managed to trap particles of antimatter briefly. He spoke about this breakthrough by telephone from his Denmark office with Earth Sky's Jorge Salazar.
Dr. Hengst, welcome to Earth Sky's Clear Voices for Science.
Thank you.
Now, tell us about the main findings of your recent experiments with antimatter, which you reported in the November 2010 edition of the journal Nature. What happened here? Tell us about that.
Okay, what we've done here for the first time is to hold on to some antihydrogen atoms. Antihydrogen is the antimatter equivalent of the most basic element, hydrogen. And we've been producing antihydrogen at CERN since about 2002. What we've done here is to not just produce it, but to produce it in a trap, as we call it. It's kind of a magnetic bottle that can hold on to the antihydrogen so that it doesn't fly off and meet a cataclysmic fate by annihilating with normal matter.
I believe the reports are that you've managed to trap 38 of these atoms of antihydrogen and keep them contained for 1/10 of a second. Is that right?
Yes, but there's nothing magical about those two numbers. This is a proof of principle experiment. So we published this as soon as we could demonstrate that this actually works. We can already trap many more and for a much longer time. So the 172 milliseconds was chosen by us. It was kind of the fastest time that we could do the experiment and then release the antihydrogen to see that it was there. The way that you do this experiment is to trap the atoms and then intentionally release them so that you can see them annihilate. That's how you know that they were there. So there's nothing, again, magical about the number. It was the number we chose. We're already doing much longer storage times, and we're improving the rate regularly.
Please explain for us what exactly is antimatter?
Okay. So everything around us is what we sort rather arbitrarily refer to as matter, normal matter. And everything you come in contact with every day is just made of three particles, protons and neutrons in the nucleus of atoms and electrons, which orbit the nucleus. Back in the 1930s, an English physicist named Paul Dirac predicted that there could be a kind of a mirror image of matter, which has, for example, the same mass as a typical matter particle, but opposite charge and some other properties that are mirror reflected, if you will. Now, matter and antimatter aren't compatible. If they meet, you get annihilation. You produce some energy, which often produces more mass again. But as far as we understand, the laws of physics say that matter and antimatter should behave in the same way. In fact, when we produce matter in the laboratory or antimatter, they come as a pair. This is where Mr. Einstein comes in. What we do at laboratories like CERN is use E equals mc squared. We take some energy, E, and we use it to produce mass, M. Right? That's what that equation is about. If you have energy in the form of high-energy particles, you can use them produce more mass, and we look for new things typically. But every time we produce mass from energy in the laboratory, we get equal amounts of matter and antimatter. So this brings up a big question about the origin of the universe, because if the Big Bang was an energy event, then there should have been equal amounts of matter and antimatter at the beginning of creation. It looks like the universe chose matter over antimatter. Again, the two are incompatible, but we don't really understand why the universe took a left turn instead of a right turn. And that's one of the mysteries about antimatter. That's one of the things that fascinates scientists about it.
Right, and maybe this also kind of gets at a question that we got from Facebook. Tanja Archiberg from Copenhagen, she wrote us and says, you know, does this really matter? And aren't some things better left alone? Tell us, what are your thoughts on this study of antimatter?
Well, to us, we're trying to unravel sort of very basic questions about the universe. What's the structure of space and time? How did our universe evolve? There's no real danger in what we do. We're not unleashing some unknown energy source or something like that. That's purely science fiction. What we're really trying to do is ask fundamental questions. And the question in our experiment is, do matter and antimatter obey the same laws of physics? It's really very simple. So in no way is this a topic that needs to be left alone. It's not a danger to anybody.
Explain to us, how was antimatter made? How was it contained? Tell us about that.
Okay, sure. The reason we're at CERN is that we need a machine that can produce antiprotons. Those are the nuclei of the antihydrogen atom. It's just the opposite of a proton. A proton has a positive charge, an antiproton has a negative charge. So we've been working with antiprotons for many, many years, but you need an accelerator to produce them. So the reason we're at CERN is that they have a very special machine that produces antiprotons for us and then slows them down. It's kind of an accelerator in reverse. It's called the antiproton decelerator. So it can produce some number of antiprotons for us, which we then trap. We make a kind of electromagnetic bottle that can hold on to the antiprotons. The other ingredient is positrons. These are the anti-electrons. And positrons are much more common. You can go to a hospital and have what's called a PET scan, positron emission tomography, where they actually inject a positron emitter into your body and then watch what happens. And what our experiment does then is to mix antiprotons and positrons at very low temperatures, just a few degrees above absolute zero, to make antihydrogen atoms. Okay? And we've been doing that, as I said, since 2002. My previous experiment was called Athena. It demonstrated how to do that, to make antihydrogen from their components.
Right, that was a breakthrough in just being able to create these particles.
That's right. That was a big deal also back in 2002. We had sort of similar media coverage to what we're looking at now, and that was a major milestone to show that you could do it in quantity. And today we can make about 1,000 antihydrogen atoms per second when we do our experiment. Okay, but back in 2002, the antiprotons and the antielectrons, the positrons, when they combine, they're in an electromagnetic trap. They both have a charge, but when you put them together, they make a neutral atom. And that thing is not confined in the kind of trap that we had in Athena. So it would just fly off, hit some matter, and annihilate. In fact, that's how we detected that we could do this. We looked for the annihilation. It's a very characteristic signal of an antiproton and a positron annihilating. The step we're doing now is we have an extra trap around the formation trap. So what we do is surround the formation region with a kind of a magnetic bottle. And when the antihydrogen atom is born, if it's not moving too quickly, it gets trapped in this magnetic bottle. And this is the first experiment to demonstrate that this is possible. And just to give you an idea how difficult that is, in temperature units, these anti-atoms have to have less than 0.5 degrees above absolute zero. Otherwise, they just fly out of this magnetic bottle. And that's what's made this so difficult and why it's such a breakthrough.
So these particles of anti-hydrogen that were created by your laboratory, they're starting to be contained, they're starting to be controlled, they're starting to be studied. What do scientists hope to find out? I mean, maybe you could tell us a little bit about what you know.
Okay, so the next step is we often refer to as shining light on antimatter, because that's exactly what we want to do. We want to take a laser and make antihydrogen interact with light. Now, when atoms absorb and emit light, they do it at very discrete colors, if you will. we usually refer to the frequency of the light, but it corresponds to what color the atom likes to absorb. Those frequencies or energies are quantized. That's the whole point behind the original quantum theory of the atom.
Yeah, and listeners may be familiar with, like, sodium lights have a certain color.
Exactly. Yeah. Right? So hydrogen likes to absorb certain colors of light. And we want to see if antihydrogen absorbs exactly the same color. And to give you an idea of what exact means in atomic physics, the frequency of the light that you need to excite hydrogen from its first ground state level to its second level is known to about 2 parts in 10 to the 14. That's 0.1302. Okay? So it's very, very precisely known. What we'd like to do is measure the same frequency in antihydrogen to see if those two numbers are the same. And that would tell us whether antihydrogen and hydrogen obey the same laws of physics. So that's the long-term goal.
Dr. Hanks, thank you for speaking with us. What's the most important thing you want people today to know about antimatter?
Well, that this is a fascinating substance that, for some reason, nature chose not to give us. And that should inspire people's curiosity and get them to look harder, ask questions about why this is and why is the universe the way it is. That's the kind of thing that inspires us to go looking.
You've been listening to physicist Jeffrey Hengst of the University of Aarhus in Denmark. To subscribe to this and other free science interview podcasts, visit the subscribe page at earthsky.org. I'm Deborah Bird. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.